The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy? The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister at the current circumstances could deepen divisions as the Israeli war on Gaza rages. This is what some Palestinian factions revealed after President Mahmoud Abbas appointed Mohammed Mustafa, a long-trusted advisor on economic affairs, as prime minister and tasked him with forming a new government. Both Hamas and resistance movements, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Palestinian National Initiative said that without national consensus, it's a reinforcement of a policy of exclusion and the deepening of division. We met Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouti, Secretary General of the National Initiative. He told us that the most important thing is now a unified leadership.
We're not against the new government. We're against the way the government is being formed. We want a national consensus government, a government which is acceptable and accepted by all Palestinian political groups through a national dialogue between the different groups. And that is natural because, and for us, the main goal first before forming a government is how we structure a unified Palestinian national leadership.
Mohammed Mustafa replaces Mohammed Shtayyeh, who resigned less than 3 weeks ago, citing the need for real change. Experts, however, say there had been mounting pressure on Abbas to reform the Palestinian Authority and initiate the establishment of a political framework capable of governing a future Palestinian state to take charge of all Palestinian territories after the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza ends.
First of all, that there was a pressure on the Palestinian Authority to make some changes, and that's why they complied immediately and appointing Mohammed Mustafa as the new prime minister. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, which is most importantly as well, what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians don't want another government to be the same. The problem here is with Israel. Are they, and the international community, are they able to really make the change and let this government to work or not?
The new prime minister now would work to form a technocratic government of experts. Abbas has also asked Mustafa to create plans to reunite the administration of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, reform the government, and address internal corruption.
A real political change, not a change in words only, is what the people here desire. Moreover, the upcoming government faces numerous challenges, namely rebuilding the Gaza Strip, torpedoing Israeli plans to control the coastal enclave, and managing Palestinians' lives. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
On Saturday, thousands of people joined a new rally in the Italian capital, organized, among the others, by the Movement of the Palestinian Students and the Association of the Palestinians in Italy. The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide, also saw the participation of high school students and families. People at the rally strongly condemned Italy's unwavering support to the Israeli regime.
Italy, that claims to be a democratic nation, is a country where the government goes against the people's will. Profits always come first, even when a genocide is taking place. I'm teaching my kids to never give up the fight and to never accept being submitted.
The Italian Defense Minister Guido Crosetto has recently said that Rome has continued to export arms to Israel despite assurances last year that the government was blocking such sales following Tel Aviv's invasion of the Gaza Strip. Some Italian media reports recently revealed that despite the Italian government's denials, the value of arms sales to Israel more than tripled in December 2023 compared with the same month in 2022. And December last year was the peak of Israeli bombardments on the Gaza Strip.
Western governments have been systematically supporting Zionism and Israel's criminal regime, notwithstanding the protests against Israel's crimes that have been taking place across the globe. Italy's support to Tel Aviv must stop once and for all.
A solution to the onslaught in Gaza could be found if the international community stopped militarily supporting Israel. Italy, on its side, has been actively arming Israel through companies such as Leonardo and others. If we don't make sure that the Palestinians' right to self-determination is protected, then nothing will ever change.
Earlier this week, more protests and initiatives in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians were held in several Italian cities, including Milan and Naples. Max Civili, Rome.
A growing strategic partnership between Azerbaijan and Iran in the energy sector on full display. A collaboration that promises to bolster economic development and energy security beyond the borders of the two countries and in the region, as described by the Iranian Minister of Energy and his visiting Azerbaijani counterpart. A highlight of this cooperation is the near completion of hydroelectric power plants on the Aras River, a vital waterway on the Iran-Azerbaijan border, with construction progress reported at 96%. The strategic importance of these hydroelectric projects extends beyond national benefits, signaling a move towards greater energy independence and regional cooperation, including the creation of an energy bridge linking Azerbaijan, Iran, and Russia by connecting Iran and Russia's power grids through the Republic of Azerbaijan. This follows decisions made 2 weeks ago during the 17th Iran-Russia Joint Economic Commission in Tehran to boost economic relations in different fields. Managing shared water resources for energy production lays the groundwork for more mutually beneficial cooperation, which is why the presidents of both countries will be attending the inaugural ceremony.
The projects are in the final stages, promising a significant boost in Iran-Azerbaijan bilateral relations, all in line with President Ebrahim Raisi's policy to expand relations with neighboring countries. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
The top annual analysis of global arms sales found that France has risen to the number two weapons exporter in the world. The gains have often been made thanks to debt from Ukraine, which has become Europe's largest arms importer. French arms sales have soared 50% in recent years and now comprise 11% of the global market. The world's leading arms dealer is still the United States, which controls a record 42% of the global weapons trade. Arms sales to Ukraine has proven to be big business, and it may explain President Emmanuel Macron's about-face on the conflict. 2 years ago, Macron warned that Russia must not be humiliated, but he's recently become one of Europe's leading anti-Russia war hawks. France's top three arms clients are India, which is the world's largest arms importer, followed by Saudi Arabia and tiny but rich Qatar. Africa is still reeling from 40 tons of illegal free arms drops France made in 2011 to support anti-Gaddafi rebels in Libya. As predicted, the weapons soon found their way to Syria, the Central African Republic, Ukraine, and elsewhere. This week, French Parliament approved a 10-year military pact with Kiev, which guarantees billions in more weapons deliveries. Russia continues to gain ground against NATO-backed Ukraine, which is an important reminder that some weapons are made to work under actual wartime conditions, and some are made mainly for sales and profit. Robin Mazaheri, Paris.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles de Verre, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign.
We are witnessing a new movement in the world. The atrocities committed in Gaza are no longer only a matter that concerns Muslim countries. Far from it. Here we have a French lawyer that has started an initiative that brought together 300 lawyers from across the world in less than 10 days, and that number grew rapidly to 100,000. And now with the MOU that we have signed at the Iran Judiciary Bar, that number will be rising to 50,000 lawyers. With Iran on board, you can also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
And an optimistic Gilles de Verre, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true, because the humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why, while the South African government files a complaint, we see a grassroots movement also taking shape, a very unique one that has brought together lawyers who are seeking justice in the battle between good and evil.
And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach. Lawyers believe that we live in a new era in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
An annual meeting of Quran reciters and memorizers with the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Every year on the first day of the holy month of Ramadan, leader of the Islamic Revolution receives top reciters of the Holy Quran to stress the importance of this very holy book in the lives of Muslims.
In the meeting, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the recitation of the Quran as a sacred art, while underlining that the primary objective of this very valuable skill should be to convey the meaning and message of the Quran to the public and society and create the ground for contemplation of the Holy Scripture. Elsewhere in his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei expressed his satisfaction with the abundant number of young Quran reciters in the country, viewing their increase as a blessing of the Islamic Revolution. Meanwhile, referring to the crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza, the leader pointed out that the peak of resilience that is being witnessed in Gaza presently stems from a profound familiarity with and adherence to the teachings of the Quran. Before the meeting, young and experienced reciters and memorizers were very much excited to listen and take a glimpse of the leader.
I am very much excited to recite some verses of the Holy Quran in the presence of the leader. But this is a great opportunity for me to see the leader.
This is the third time I have the honor of attending such a great event. Today I am going to have supplications to recite about the holy month of Ramadan.
Other reciters were worried about the people of Gaza who are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign.
The month of Ramadan is the month of mercy and blessing. I do believe that during this month, the Zionist regime will face a big defeat.
At the end of the ceremony, the Quran reciters and memorizers held congregational prayers led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution and broke their fast together. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
March 20, 1951, members of the Iranian parliament passed a bill introduced by the country's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, to nationalize Iran's oil industry. The groundbreaking initiative put an end to Britain's four-decade dominion over Iran's oil industry. The Britain-owned Anglo-Iranian oil company enjoyed a monopolistic control over the industry and paid only a meager portion of the revenues to the Iranian government.
Nationalization was a call for independence. If you go back then, the Iranians, the entire public, realized that this move was not about economy. It was about independence. And ergo, the Mossadegh movement was very popular within. And the entire world realized that it was about gaining independence from a colonial power that controlled the economy and based on the economy, controlled the political spectrum within Iran.
When the then government of Mossadegh put the nationalizing of Iran's oil on its agenda in April 1951, acts of sabotage and conspiracy against the country were enhanced. The American-British coup in August 1953 against Mossadegh's government was part of the plot.
Basically, the British were plundering Iranian natural resources, and oil was at the top of the list. Iranians began to protest, and there was a growing social movement in the country to nationalize Iranian oil. When that ultimately happened, the British imposed sanctions on the country, similar to what happened after the revolution in Iran.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran achieved significant milestones in the petroleum industry. These include the discovery of numerous oil and gas fields, an expansion in extractable oil and condensate reserves, a rise in oil production and extractable gas, and the discovery of new oil and gas fields. Iran was the first country in the West Asia to reclaim its oil industry. The Iranian nation's move proved to be of great importance in giving rise to the anti-colonialist tendencies all over the region and set a trend for other countries. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
vacation on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, I'm Gisumisha Ahmadi in the Spotlight. Israel's restrictions on humanitarian aid for the Gaza Strip may amount to a war crime. Now, those are the words of the UN Human Rights Chief. This, as the European Union's top diplomat also on Monday accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war by preventing humanitarian aid from reaching Gaza. Now, in this edition, we will be discussing what this actually means from a humanitarian point of view to a legal issue. And in order to do that, I am joined by Daniel Yagich, who is joining us from Beirut, and also Paul Laroudi, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joining us live from Berkeley. Let's begin with our guest from Beirut, Mr. Yagich. The International, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the IPC report, released on Monday, says that malnutrition and food shortages have probably exceeded famine levels in northern Gaza. What do we mean by exceeding famine levels? Because I believe for us and most of our viewers, famine itself is the extreme.
I mean, it is catastrophic to even think about what a situation in Gaza must be like now, 6 months into this genocide. And of course, we need to keep in mind that in addition to what the Israeli regime has been conducting for the past half a year and using starvation now as a method of war, the context before October 7th was awful in Gaza as well. I mean, the UN and human rights organizations have in a previous decade warned that Gaza would be uninhabitable at the beginning of this decade. So the current Israeli genocide, of course, adds even more to a situation in which the population had already been under a siege for many years and under a blockade. And it's very difficult to imagine what the outcome of all of this will be, because starvation now is added as an additional form of warfare, in addition to the bombings and killings of Palestinians in so many different ways, as we have seen being live streamed actually by the perpetrator, the Israeli regime, for the past half a year.
Okay, let's bring in Mr. Paul Ladouri. Mr. Ladouri, we've been hearing the word "may" too often. This may be considered a war crime, it may be considered a genocide. Why are officials refraining from clearly stating that using food and starvation as a weapon against Palestinians is a war crime, and what Israelis are doing there is a genocide?
Well, diplomats and UN officials are always overly cautious. They want to wait until something like the International Court of Justice or the ICC or some official body declares that this is in fact the case. They defer to other authorities to verify what they say in cautious terms publicly. But the fact is, everybody knows this. In fact, the Israelis have not been hiding it at all. Their public officials have been advocating the use of disease exposure, that is, exposure to the elements by destroying the homes of Palestinians, and starvation, and the lack of clean water, drinking water, potable water, as means of eliminating the Palestinians. They specifically have said openly and publicly that their intention is to eliminate the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So this is hardly a secret, and it matters little what the United Nations officials say to it. It's happening first in the north of Gaza, where delivery of aid is at its least extent, and where they are eating grass and whatever they can manage, animal feed. We know all the stories. But this is intentional. The Israeli military has been destroying markets and warehouses full of food. They have been bombing the farms and the animals and everything. Their intention, and why are they doing that? Why are they doing this? It's because when they shoot somebody or bomb somebody, they are blamed for killing them. When they starve them to death, they haven't actually touched them, have they? But their intention is, and if they have the means, within months or however long it takes, they will starve people to death. And in fact, as we know, children especially and the elderly and others have actually starved to death. This was predicted, and it's happening.
You're absolutely right. And the fact that it is being done intentionally, let's move back to our guest in Beirut. Well, we do know that the ICJ issued a provisional ruling stating that humanitarian aid needs to get to the people in Gaza immediately. And that provisional ruling was issued only because it was supposed to be implemented immediately, which the Israelis completely overlooked. And that itself obviously requires a ceasefire, because you can't send humanitarian aid under constant bombardment. So does this leave any room to doubt Israel's intentions as using food insecurity as a weapon against Gazans?
There is absolutely no doubt. The Israelis have been very transparent in both their goals and in the ways in which they want to achieve them. And this has been very well documented. The Israeli regime, for the past weeks and months, has openly bragged about their genocidal intentions and very clearly made clear that they want to remove Palestinians from Gaza through policies of ethnic cleansing and genocide. So this is very clear. What is happening, what we see more on the political and media discourse, is that in particular the Western political and media elites, including we have to mention the European Union, are investing crucial efforts in providing propaganda on behalf of the Israeli regime, and to basically, to some extent, even in the use of language, conceal this very transparent communication that the Israelis are actually providing for the entire world to see. So there's absolutely no doubt about what the Israelis are intending to do. And also here, if we look at the broader historical context, this is a settler colony that only works under the framework of apartheid, and the movement or the ideology of Zionism on which this was founded is inherently anti-indigenous. It's a colonial movement with the idea that Palestine should be settled by the settlers and it's not the land of the indigenous people. In fact, if we go back to the early writings of Zionism, Palestine is fantasized as, I'm quoting here, a land without a people for a people without a land, and so on. So the genocidal intent is very clear in at least the political discourse by the Israeli regime, but much more so stretches throughout decades of Zionism, and what we see now should not be a surprise, nor should there be any doubt about the intentions of the Israeli regime.
Now that the intentions are obviously very clear, Mr. Larudi, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name at first, Mr. Larudi, we are using some words that previously we would see them in historical texts and referring to very serious crimes to be pursued in international courts. We are using the word war crime. We are using ethnic cleansing. We're using genocide. What is the legal aspect to this matter, and how far should the Israelis go before we can see actually a court ruling to stop this?
Well, they've seen a court ruling to stop this. The World Court has judged on this. But the problem is that there's very little in the way of enforcement. And in fact, the Genocide Convention does not, the only enforcement under the Genocide Convention is that all the signatories of the Genocide Convention, meaning 153 of them, one of whom is Israel, they are bound to do everything possible not to avoid supporting the genocide, meaning removal of all arms deliveries and other types of services to the one that's committing the genocide, or who is committing what can be called genocidal actions, since legally speaking, the World Court won't even determine that genocide takes place until after it's happened. But nevertheless, they can issue an injunction, as they have, against anything that can be considered a genocidal action. Now, that's the only thing. And you have, unfortunately, a minority of countries that are directly enabling the genocide. Most importantly, the United States sending mountains, just unlimited arms with which Israel can bombard the civilian population of Gaza unrelentingly and eliminate the population one way or another, either by expelling them somehow, although there are not any willing cooperating countries, not Egypt and not the others. But otherwise, they're not going to step back from the possibility that they might annihilate the all or most of the population of Gaza. That's not off the table.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Gegic, if you could please tell us, what are the measures that we can take to force the Israeli entity to comply?
That is a very good question, and I fear there is currently no international mechanism or institution that is able or ready to hold the Israeli regime accountable, simply because we can ask the question, who would be able to do that? And it's at this point, of course, the United States, which could put an end to this genocide very easily today. But not only is the United States not willing to end the Israeli atrocities, it is even more complicit and it is enabling this war against Palestinians. So at the end of the day, Palestinians are victims of a genocide that is being carried out by the United States and by parts of the Western world against a defenseless population which is trapped in an extermination camp that Gaza has become. And then if we look at the International Court of Justice, the United Nations, I mean, the hegemony that the United States still holds over much of the world also enables the Israeli regime to stand above international law and to get away with these atrocities and crimes while the rest of the world is able to watch them live on television. So it is very much this power imbalance of power that makes it very, at this point, as we see, impossible for any broader intervention. And at the same time, we need to keep in mind the majority of the world belongs to the global south, to the third world, and even in the UN and the General Assembly, there's a very clear majority in support of a ceasefire, in support of Palestinian human rights. But none of this can be enforced under the current so-called, the system currently the so-called international community is depending on.
So let's go back to Mr. Laroudi. Are there any ways to enforce these court rulings, the ones issued by the ICC and the ICJ? Because it would seem very irrational to have an international court set up this body without having the mechanism to enforce what it rules.
Well, I differ to some extent with my colleague Daniel, with whom I agree on almost everything else. I think there is a way to enforce the ruling and to enforce, more importantly, the will, the international will. Yemen is doing it. They are reducing the flow of naval traffic through the Red Sea. Now, it's true that it's being diverted by land, across the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, and it's getting into Israel, but not as easily, not as well, and at greater cost. In addition, some countries, and it was either this morning or yesterday, that Canada passed a bill in Parliament saying that it is not going to supply any more arms to Israel, period. And other measures were included in that. I don't have it at my fingertips, but countries can do that. And even the Netherlands has also said it will not ship spare parts. There are other ways that that countries can intervene. For example, they can. I know that airlifts have and airdrops have a bad name because of the control of Israel over these airdrops. But suppose the countries of the world, or a serious number of major countries in the world, let's say a dozen of them, decide to send without Israeli controls massive amounts of airdrops and aid into the Gaza Strip without flying through Israeli territory, only Gaza territory, and to drop aid, defying the will of the Israeli military and the airspace, and basically to take over the airspace of Gaza. These are things which are possible. Would Israel, let's say, shoot down the aircraft of nations like Spain and Norway and Belgium? Would they do that? I don't think so. I think that there are ways, and little by little, countries of the world are coming to adopt some of these ways. The United States is an obstacle, but I think even the United States will have to take some measures pretty soon. President Biden will most likely lose if he runs in the fall election. He may resign before then or decide not to run. But there are ways that the countries of the world, if they have the will to do it, they can do it with or without the United States.
You're absolutely right. And we also have the international public opinion completely shifting against Israel. We are seeing demonstrations in countries that are known to be allies of the Israeli regime. And interestingly, we see that the people in those countries are now shifting against Israel, which shows that public opinion now today is more aware of what is happening on the ground, and it is not taken by the propaganda of mainstream media in support of the Israeli regime. So back to our guest in Beirut. Do you think that public opinion can actually bring about some kind of a change?
Yeah, I think it remains to be seen in the long run to what extent the shift in public opinion or the very visible demonstrations that we're seeing, including in Western capitals, will have an impact. But for sure, we can see that to some extent it might exert pressure on elected officials. And it might also increase the very clear discrepancy between the regimes that are, most of which, in particular in the West, are tied to the Israeli regime, and the gap between them and the people. But we've also seen, especially in places such as Germany, an increase in censorship, an increase in coercion of public dissent, of protests, and a boycott of protesters by the state. So this has led in some places to even more measures that limit freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the freedom in particular when it comes to Palestine. But I do think that it's become at least much more obvious that there is a global support for human rights, and that the Palestinian cause and what is actually taking place in Palestine has become impossible to ignore at this point.
Exactly. And Mr. Larudi, this would be our last question. So in your opinion, we're also seeing a political fallout within the Zionist entity itself, with some members saying that you are going too extreme and we are losing our allies. What do you think the future holds for the Zionist entity, considering the situation?
The Zionist entity is finished. It has lost this war. It has lost the support of the international community, and it has lost the support of even the Jewish youth in the United States, which is the largest Jewish population outside Israel. In fact, I think it's even slightly larger than Israel. Israel now, it's my understanding that roughly a million Israeli Jews have left since October 7th. That's a major proportion of their population. Unfortunately, what's left in Israel is a very militant and, you can say, terrorist population. And they are extremely racist, extremely, how shall I say, bloodthirsty. It's not limited to the officials of the government. There's a large proportion of the population that supports the genocide. I think that this is going to be difficult for them to overcome. If I had to call a winner in the war, it seems to me that it's going to the side of Hamas, despite the genocide that Israel is perpetrating on the Palestinians. So, but in the meantime, we have to try to do something to stop the genocide and to spare the people of Gaza.
Exactly. We need to get that to stop. Thank you very much. We're running out of time. Mr. Daniel Yegic, author and researcher, joining us from Beirut, and Mr. Paul Larudi, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement from Berkeley. Thank you very much for joining us.
Congratulations to everyone. Congratulations to everyone.
In the limelight.
Between border visits and rallies, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are dueling to control the narrative on immigration, placing the issue and Mexico's role in it at the heart of the upcoming election. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Florida's governor signed bills on Friday, 15th of March, that increased the prison and jail sentences for immigrants who are living in the United States illegally if they're convicted of driving without a license or committing felonies. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is a frequent critic of the Biden administration over its handling of the Mexican border, sending Florida law enforcement agents and National Guard members to Texas. The Republican governor of Florida, who ended his attempt for his party's presidential nomination recently, has also flown immigrants who enter Texas illegally to Massachusetts and to California. Ron DeSantis said, We do not tolerate illegal immigration, let alone lawlessness committed by illegal aliens who shouldn't be here in the first place. The bills I signed on Friday further enhance Florida's capabilities to uphold the law. The driver's license bill increases the maximum sentence for anyone convicted of driving without a license twice or more from 60 days in jail to a year. This also applies to U.S. citizens and immigrants in the country illegally. But in Florida, undocumented people are barred from obtaining a driving license in the first place. Some immigrant support groups have criticized the bill, saying it endangers the public safety, as many immigrants are barred from getting a driving license will still drive. They just won't have been tested or buy driving insurance. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 19 states and Washington, D.C. issue driver's licenses to immigrants who are in the country illegally. Renata Bozzetto of the Florida Immigrant Coalition said in a recent statement, "True safety is achieved through comprehensive measures such as driver education, issuing driver's licenses to all qualified drivers, and access to insurance, not through punitive enforcement." Bozzetto added, "Rather than criminalizing individuals, the Republican legislature in Florida should work to invest in initiatives that promote driver safety, address disparities in the licensing process, and ensure equitable access to transportation for all residents." Another bill increases the maximum prison sentences for immigrants who are convicted of felonies after having been previously deported from the country for illegal entry. For example, such immigrants convicted of low-level felonies like simple burglary or car theft would face a maximum sentence of 15 years in prison instead of the 5-year sentence that is the crime's normal maximum. Such immigrants convicted of mid-level felonies like aggravated battery would face a maximum sentence of 30 years instead of the 15-year sentence that is those crimes' normal maximum. And higher-level felonies like armed robbery could now carry a life sentence for such immigrants instead of the normal maximum sentence of 30 years imprisonment. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Between border visits and rallies, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are dueling to control the narrative on immigration, placing the issue and Mexico's role in it at the heart of the upcoming general election. In tasking Mexico with reducing arrivals at the border, the United States has given its neighbor leverage over U.S. political discussion. Underground, this has meant many migrants find themselves stuck in Mexico, running a gauntlet of extortion and violence as they try to make it to the other side of the border, to the United States. Ari Sawyer, a researcher at Human Rights Watch, said it used to be that the Darien Gap was the most horrific part of their journey, but now people are saying that Mexico is the worst, adding that Mexico is the new jungle. There are two components to Mexico's central role in U.S. immigration. Many Mexicans are themselves going to the United States, and Mexico remains the top nationality among immigrants. Then there is Mexico's status as the United States' immigration enforcer, a role that has evolved over the course of Andrés Manuel López Obrador's presidency, starting in 2018, as a number of migrants trying to reach the United States through Mexico has risen tremendously. Compared to before the pandemic, detentions of migrants in an irregular situation have risen fourfold, reaching almost 800,000 cases in 2023. According to Tonatiuh Guin, former commissioner of Mexico's National Institute of Migration, detained people should be taken for a migration office to be reviewed. Meanwhile, consulates should be contacted and the decision made on as to whether to repatriate them. But he says if the official detention numbers are accurate, then it would be far beyond the capacity of Mexico's institutions to process them. In any case, deportations have not risen in step with detentions. On the contrary, they collapsed last year to a little over 50,000 cases. In the first year of López Obrador's administration, deportations as a percentage of detentions stood at 88%. In 2023, they stood at 6.8%. What is happening instead, according to human rights organizations, is that migrants are being put on buses and sent back south, sometimes all the way to the border with Guatemala. Rafael Velázquez, Mexico's director of the International Rescue Committee, said, "If you're detained in Mexico City, you go to Acayucan. If you're detained in Acayucan, it's Villahermosa. And if you're detained in Villahermosa, it's Palenque," adding, "In other words, you go one step back."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.